balance verses of chapter 5, and then we will proceed on with introduction to chapter 6. So after last week, we have completed chapter 5, verse number 25. And in these two verses, 25 and 26, Krishna is going to summarize what he has been discussing from chapter 3 itself. So chapter 3, 4, 5 and 6 are all connected chapters. As we have seen, from chapter 3, Krishna has been glorifying the path of karma yoga, path of selfless action. In chapter 4, he glorified the path of knowledge, jnana yoga. And thus, in chapter 5, he is merging these two parts of action and knowledge. Therefore, what we have seen so far, karma yoga, selfless action is to purify the mind. With the purified mind, one goes to jnana yoga. And in jnana yoga, one follows the process of sravanam, mananam, nididhyasanam to attain knowledge. So in these closing verses of chapter 5, verses 25 and 26, he is summarizing these two parts of karma and jnana. And what is the purpose? Because in the closing three verses, he is going to introduce the next sadhana. After karma yoga, after jnana yoga, comes the final sadhana, which is known as dhyana yoga, which is meditation, which is the subject of the whole of chapter 6. So in verses 27, 28 and 29, he will briefly introduce the process of meditation. And then he will expand the whole meditation path in chapter 6. So let us look again at verse number 25, in which Krishna is summarizing the two parts of karma and jnana. And what he says is, what he is reminding us of the sadhanas that we all have to go through. How do we go through karma yoga and jnana yoga? All the sadhanas here are being mentioned. So, first of all, he has given us the first sadhana in verse 25, second line, when he says, Chinna Kalmasha. Chinna Kalmasha. Kalmasha, as we explained last week, means sins or papam. And what is this sins or papam? Chinna means to destroy. This one has to first destroy all your sins or your papam. And what was the definition of sins or papam as we discussed last week? Impurities like
mental agitations.
Mental that cause mental agitations like desire, anger, lust, greed, etc. These are what is known as sins or papam, because these mental agitation will drive us to do wrong actions. And when we do wrong actions, they become a barrier to our spiritual growth. Therefore, sins are nothing but thoughts and actions which are a barrier to our spiritual growth. So first of all, Krishna says you have to chinna kalmasha, you have to destroy, get rid of all these mental impurities. And how do we get rid of mental impurities? How do we get rid of all these mental impurities? Through prayers, through service, through rituals, through self-service, through seva, we focus on other people rather than our own selfish needs. So we slowly dilute away the mental impurities. Then what is another sadhana that we should engage in? Or what is the quality of this devotee? And that we can see in the last line of verse 25, that is, Sarva Bhuta Hite Rataha. Rataha means to be engaged. Hite means in the welfare of Sarva Bhuta. One who engages in the welfare of all beings. Therefore, we should learn to expand our mind away from our selfish needs to identify with the needs of others. And what happens when we can share in the joy of others, when others are happy, when we can share in the joy of others, what is the end result? If we can sensitize our mind to feel the joy of others, what is our benefit? How do you get peace? You don't feel jealous, you don't feel envious, so all these qualities also go away when we can share in the joy of others. And also when we can share in the happiness of others, there also arises another quality. How can we hurt other people also? We won't even have the intention to hurt others if we can feel the joy and the pain of others also. And if we can also feel the pain of others, what other benefits do we have? One is we feel the joy of others. The other is we feel the pain of others also. One, we won't hurt people, and at the same time also, we won't try to look down upon these people. We don't get joy when they suffer. So you share in the joys and sorrow of others. That is how we sensitize our mind also. We purify the mind also through this. So all these processes, these sadhanas are given for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is purification of mind. Sarva bhuta hite rataha, the attitude to help others through seva, through dhanam. And if you cannot help through dhanam and through seva, the least you can do is at least pray for them. As we pray, sarve bhavantu sukhina, may all be happy. The third sadhana that Krishna discussed here is given in the third line of verse 25. Yata manaha. Here the word atmanaha means all the organs of the body, meaning body, senses, mind. What should we do with the body and the senses and the mind? Krishna says yataha. Yataha means to bring self-discipline, practice self-discipline, control your senses, control your mind, so that you can take your life in the direction that you want it. And therefore this also includes austerities also, practicing like fasting is example, pranayama, breath control. All these are methods or sadhanas for us to deploy to control or discipline the body, the mind and the senses also. Keep them under strict control. And then one more sadhana that Krishna mentions here in the second line. Rishaya Chinna Dveda. Dveda are doubts. There is a lot of ignorance in our mind. There are a lot of doubts in our mind. Krishna says Chinna means to free or to destroy these doubts in your mind. And when you do that, Krishna gives you a title. He says you are called a Rishi. Rishi is one who wears orange garments or the garments of a monk, but a Rishi means one who has a mind that is capable of pondering over subtle matters, over more higher, who has higher thoughts, more divine thoughts. Such a person is called a Rishi. So here he says, Rishaya Chinna Dveda. Free yourself and focus, free yourself from doubts and make your mind purified and ponder on the more higher truths of life. And how do we free ourselves from doubts? All the doubts that we have, how do we free ourselves from that?
Knowledge.
Through knowledge, exactly. Through sravanam mananam. So the process of freeing ourselves from all doubts is the process of jnana yoga or sravanam mananam. And finally, if you go through all these sadhanas which is mentioned in verse number 25, Krishna says, Labante Brahma Nirvanam. Labante means they attain. What do they attain? Brahma, the state of Nirvanam, the state of infinite peace, oneness with Brahman. And again, we must remember when we say we attain the state of Brahman, it is not a physical change in us. What does it imply? At peace, what does it imply? What does it mean when we say we are one with Brahman, we have merged with Brahman, and this is while we are alive, while we are living, if we have gone through these sadhanas in the right way?
Jivan
Mukta, which means it is a total change of mindset, how we look at the world. It is a totally peaceful mind which is able to adjust to all kinds of external situations. So here, becoming one with Brahman is not any physical change, but it is a total internal change, a total mental attitude which is now changed, and how you deal with all your people, with how you deal with people, how you deal with objects, how you deal with situations in life. So it is a process we go through. We start from one and we climb the spiritual ladder and we go through a different mindset change. And there is a dialogue that appears in Ramayana when Lord Rama asks Hanuman one day. He asks Hanuman, how do you look at me? When you see me, what is your relationship with me? And Hanuman gives a very beautiful reply in this section of Ramayana when he says, Deha Buddhaya Tava Daso. Buddhaya means when I consider myself as the Deha, as the body, then Tava Daso, I am your servant. I look upon you as the master and I am your servant. When I have the identification that I am this body, then I consider you as a master and I am your servant. Dasa means servant. But he says, then he goes on to say, Jiva Buddhaya Tvam Amsha. When I consider myself this Jiva, that means this individual consciousness, I don't consider myself as a body, but the individual consciousness, then I look upon you as I am an Amsha. Amsha means I am a fraction of you. I am a parcel of you. That means a relationship that is like a father and a son. When I look upon myself as a body, my relationship is you are the master, I am the servant. When I look upon myself as a jiva in this body, then my relationship with you is I am part and parcel of you. You are the whole, I am a fraction of you. And then he goes on to say, Atma Buddhaya Tvam Evacha. When I consider myself as the universal consciousness, not just this individual consciousness, but I identify myself with the universal consciousness, then I look upon you as the, then there is no difference between you and me. You are me and I am you. So this is the transitional change that we all go through. First of all, we look upon ourselves as a devotee of God. When we go through karma yoga and we go through what we call bhakti yoga, but when we come to knowledge, we understand that we are part of, we are the same as this total consciousness, then there is no difference between that supreme consciousness and us also. And that is what it means here. Labhante Brahman Nirvana. One becomes one with Brahman. One attains the state of Brahman. There is no more division between you and the supreme consciousness. Then in verse number 26, Krishna carries on to tell us about this sadhana and the result of all this sadhana also. So earlier on in verse number 23, he mentioned about the dangers of kama krodha. Kama is desire, krodha is anger. And we discussed that in detail when we understood that we have to, we cannot suppress kama krodha, but we must learn how to handle it when desire and anger arises in us. So Krishna says, kama krodha viyuktanam. That once it arises in you, you should be able to master it. One who is totally free from the shackles of desire and anger. such a person is called Viyuktana. And it takes a lot of practice, because we do carry these desires, this anger or disappointments and frustrations, which is a part and parcel of our subconscious mind. This has been carried forward through many births and also in this birth. So no matter whatever spiritual practices we do, there will always linger some state of desire, some state of frustration, and this cannot be totally controlled, and they must not, cannot be suppressed. You must learn how to control them. When we say control, means when the desire arises, what do you mean by control?
Withstand.
Withstand. Withstand meaning what? You don't suppress.
Don't suppress.
So
control it.
You don't allow it to be expressed in terms of your actions. You don't allow the desire to express. That control you have. The desire arising in you, you may not have that. You may not be able to totally suppress that. But what control you have is not to allow yourself to express that desire, not express that frustration or that anger. And of course, ultimately, we have to turn the attention of the mind away to higher and noble thoughts, so that these desires and frustrations gradually get sublimated. So here Krishna says, Kama Krodha Viyuktana. And we also understood that anger is nothing but an offshoot of desire. So ultimately we have to get to the root cause of handling our desires. Once we are master of the desires, then there is no way for anger or frustration, etc., to arise also. So management of kama and krodha is very important. When we recall the very important teachings of Vedanta, and what are the teachings, the very important or fundamental teachings of Vedanta? My happiness does not depend on what I have, but my happiness depends on what I am. My happiness should not depend on what I have. My happiness depends on what I am. Therefore, it is very important that we have noble thoughts. We have higher thoughts. Our ultimate goal is not our acquisition and preservation. Our ultimate goal is moksha. So if this is understood, the desire for acquisition and preservation, it gets sublimated, it gets diluted. And we conserve. Right now our energies are all being used up. Why? Because either we are on the path of acquisition, or we are trying to preserve and hold on to what we have. But once we place higher value or higher goals in life, then we do not get obsessed with acquisition and preservation. Therefore, we conserve our energy and direct it towards more noble and higher pursuits also. Spiritual growth. And another quality that Krishna mentions here, again, actually it's kind of a repetition, because he is trying to hammer in this point also. And that is yata chetasa. Chetasa here means mind. So yata means to develop a tranquility of the mind. Focus the mind on the primary goal of life. Do not lose sight of your primary goal in life. And that primary goal of life is moksha. Once we value this primary goal in life, then we will discipline our lives to what we call to meet that primary goal. So that is called yata chetasa. Focus your mind on the primary goal of life. What is the purpose of this human birth, we have to understand. That is what the scriptures are telling us. After so many births you have gone through, just to attain this human birth, it has been gifted to you for a particular purpose. We must try to understand what is the purpose of the human birth. Once we understand that, we cannot go wrong. Then we know what is the right action to use this body, to use this mind, to use this intellect, for what purpose it has been given to us. Yata chetasa. And then finally Krishna says yatinam. Yatinam here, the word yatinam is another word for sannyasi. And here by Krishna saying you become a sannyasi does not mean you leave your home, wear orange robes and go and sit down in ashram. So what type of sannyasi should you become? Yatina means become a sannyasi. What type of sannyasi should you become?
Be in the world, don't get affected.
Be what?
Be in the world.
But don't get affected. So in short, what type of sannyasi is that?
In the mind, be a sannyasi.
Be a mental sannyasi. Not a physical sannyasi, be a mental sannyasi. What is a mental sannyasi? He explained to us in this very chapter. If you just go back and refer chapter 5 verse 13. Refer to chapter 5 verse 13 on page 105. And what is the definition of a sannyasi that he gave us? Mentally renouncing all actions and self-control, the renunciate rests happily in the city of nine gates. City of nine gates meaning this physical body. Mentally renouncing, not physically renouncing, it's a very important word there. Sarva karmani manasa sannyasa. Sarva karmani, all your actions, manasa mentally, sannyasa, renounce them mentally. So when we say renounce mentally, what do we mean? You are doing the actions, but he's saying mentally renounce. What does it mean?
You're doing something, but you're not attached to it.
Right. So how do you act detached?
You are just doing it because it's your duty.
Duty, and thus you surrender everything to
God.
You surrender everything to God. You leave everything in the hands of God. When we cultivate that attitude, when we are able to totally surrender everything in the hands of God, while we carry on all our actions and duties and responsibilities, that is called mental renunciation. So here he says again, Yati Nam, reminding us about this mental renunciation. Turn your house into an ashram. Otherwise, if you are not able to practice mental renunciation, even if you go to an ashram also, you would still be very agitated. So what is important is, do your actions, take care of all your responsibilities, but surrender all your actions to Lord and receive all the results as Ishvara Prasadam. That is called Yatina. And then Krishna says, such a person is one who is Vidita Atmanam. The word Vidita Atmanam here, Kama Krodha Yatinam Yata Chetasam. Vidita Atmanam, you can see in the last line of verse number 26. That means one who is self-realized, who has this direct experience of the bliss within. Such a person is called a Vidita Atmanam, a realized soul, who has found the very source of Satchit Ananda. All the scriptures are telling us, you are Sat. What do you mean by Sat? What do you mean by truth?
You are the Atmanam.
So what does truth mean? Isn't it a body truth? If you pinch me, I feel pain. Yet the scriptures are telling us the body is false, but you are truth. But we say, the body also is truth. I feel pain. Then why do you say the body is false?
Because it's not permanent.
Exactly. So when we say truth means what is permanent. What remains the same yesterday is the same today and must be the same tomorrow. Whereas we cannot apply this logic to the body. We cannot even apply to the mind because the mind is changing every day. We cannot even apply it to the intellect because the intellect also is evolving every day. So when the scriptures say you are Sat, it means you are eternal, you are imperishable. But yet we keep on identifying ourselves with this perishable body. Then the scriptures say you are Chit. Chit means what? Consciousness. You are a what you call a fountain of consciousness. But we say this body also is consciousness. But the scriptures are telling us this body is not, it is achit, it is not conscious. And we have to understand that. Therefore, why is this body Why does this body have consciousness? Why is this body physically alive and able to act? And yet the scriptures are saying the body is matter, and matter, as we know, has got no life of its own. But then the scriptures are saying there is another element which is called the chit, which is consciousness. So what the scripture says, when the chit occupies the body, it lends its consciousness to the body. It is just like last time we discussed that if you have a metal rod has got no property of heat. But if you bring a flame next to the metal rod, the fire has a property of heat, and when you bring it close to the metal rod, what happens? The heat gets transferred to the metal rod, and as a result the metal rod becomes bright and it becomes hot. But that is not the property of the metal rod, it is a borrowed property. Similarly, that is the relationship between Atman, which is said to be Chit, which is a fountain of life and consciousness. When it occupies the body borrows this sentiency from the Atman and it comes alive. It appears to be alive. That's why the scriptures are telling us, understand the real consciousness, which is the Chit, which is Atman. And third is, this consciousness is a fountain of Ananda, it is bliss. Whatever bliss you are experiencing from the world is actually not coming from the world. It is that experience of bliss which is coming from within. Satchit Ananda. So here Krishna says that person, Vidita Atmanam, is one who has realized this highest truth. That I am Satchit Ananda. I am not this temporary body, this temporary mind, this temporary intellect. And what is the state of such a person? Here Krishna says, Abhita Brahma Nirvana Vartate. Abhita means both ways. Both ways, Brahma Nirvana means they have attained the state of Brahma Nirvana. Vartate means exists. The state of Brahma Nirvana exists both ways. So what does both ways means? They live in the awareness of this totality in both ways, meaning while they are living, they experience this sense of totality. They identify with the total consciousness while living, which is the state described in the scriptures as Jivan Muktaha. While living, you are Muktaha, you are free. And the second way is, when you are able to reach this state of Jivan Muktaha while living, it is for sure that upon death also, you are also free. So that is what it means by both ways. While living, and when this body drops, you will also achieve that state which is called Videha Muktaha. That means you do not come back for another cycle of birth and death. You are totally free. So both ways means, while living you are free, upon the fall or death of this body, you are also totally free. It is like, for example, the Shastras give us the example of thought and space. Space which is in the pot, when there is space in the pot, what is the difference with space in the pot and outside the pot? What is the difference?
In the pot is conformed to the shape of that pot.
Right. But what is the difference in it?
It's the same.
The space in the pot, the quality of the space, if we talk about the sameness, there is no difference between the space in the pot and outside the pot. So when we identify as ourselves as a Jivan Mukta, that is space in the pot, what happens when the pot is broken? The space in the pot merges with the space outside the pot. That is called Videha Mukta. Either way, there is no difference at all in the space, which is in the pot or outside the pot. The only thing is the division is caused by the size or shape of the pot itself. So, Jivan Muktaha will lead to Videha Muktaha, which means a very important point. Mukti or moksha must be attained while living. It is not a state to be attained after death. If you are unable to attain the state of Jivan Muktaha while living, there is no possibility that you will attain Videha Muktaha. So Jivan Muktaha is something which is possible and can be attained while living and must be attained while living. So that is the result. Now up to this verse number 26, Krishna has completed the discussion of Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, which started from chapter 3 itself. And now he wants to introduce the next sadhana, which is meditation, Jnana Yoga. So these three verses, 27, 28 and 29, will briefly introduce the technique of meditation. And what is meditation prescribed for, we will get into that when we reach the next chapter. But now we just trying to understand the very basics of meditation that Krishna is introducing here. So now here, he is now describing a person who is sitting down in meditation. What are the what are the practices to be observed? So first of all, he says, if you look at the last line of verse 27, Nasa Vyanta Charinam. Nasa Abhyantara Charinam, which means the breath which is moving through your nostrils. First of all, you have to regulate the breathing. That is very important. First of all, when we sit in meditation, we don't just close the eyes and try to blank out the mind. First, he says, regulate that breathing. And what is that breathing? And the third line of verse 27, he has described that prana apana samaha kritva. Samaha kritva. Kritva means making, samaha, equalizing, prana, the outgoing breath, and apana, the ingoing breath. Now what it means is this basically. When we intake breath, we hold it in our lungs. That timing. And when we exhale breath and we hold the breath out of the body, that is to be slowly equalized. And what happens when you are able to, you see, the main thing is you are supposed to concentrate on the breathing. That is what he means. Be very conscious of your breathing. Why is it very important to be conscious of your breathing during meditation or before you go into the state of meditation? What is the relevance of the state of breathing?
Breathing. The faster the breathing, the more agitated the mind.
The mind. So yeah. The breath and the mind are interconnected, are interlinked. Therefore, imagine if you are coming from outside. You have various interactions in the world with people, etc. And you come back and immediately try to sit down for meditation. The state of the mind has got to be brought under some discipline. And how do we do that? We be very conscious first of our breathing. And as you know, when a person is agitated, angry, definitely the breathing gets very violent. So first of all, when you sit down, be very conscious about your breathing. Slowly try to regulate it and bring it to your control. And that will ensure at least your mind also has now settled down. So make the breathing relax and equalize it. That means basically having even breath, having a comfortable, relaxed and even breath. Then he says, what is the next thing you should be aware of? Look at the second line. Chakshus antare bruvo. Antare means at the juncture. Bruvo means the eyebrows. The eyes should focus in between the eyebrows. Now this is a very painful exercise in the body. He is saying, fix your eyes in between the eyebrows. How do you do it? In fact, this point in between your eyebrows is a very important point because it is known as the Agnya Chakra. It is the final, there are seven chakras right from the base of the spine up to the highest chakra is the Sahasrara Chakra, from which the soul leaves the body at time of death. And if the soul leaves from this point, then assured is their moksha. So for those realized soul, that's where the soul leaves the body, and this is why you hear the popping of the sound at the time when they cremate. You can hear a pop sound That is basically what we call from where the soul is living. That is a pop song that you hear if you listen closely. Okay, now here he is saying, Chakshus Chayvantare Bhruvo. Focus your eyes at the point at the middle of your eyebrows. How do you do that?
Look up.
You close your eyes and imagine.
That's why the word chaiva is very important. As though it is at the point between your eyebrows. Not that you are trying to look at the point between. As though, what it means is that concentrate, bring your mind and concentrate at the point in between your eyebrows. Fix a point of concentration in between your eyebrows. And later on he also explained that at the beginning part of meditation, one should not close your eyes totally. Because if you have not disciplined your mind, the minute you close your eyes, what happens? Your mind starts running. So if you have not mastered meditation, it is advisable that you focus, open your eyes and focus upon something. Be it your Ishta Devata, be it a Om symbol, be it a flame, whatever it is, keep your eyes focused on an object. Until you have mastered meditation, then you can eventually close your eyes. So here he says, imagine that your eyes are focused at the point in between your eyebrows, which is, as I said, a very spiritual point, which is an awakening of the consciousness, because as it goes through the chakras, if it reaches here, it means knowledge. That Ajna Chakra means an awakening of knowledge also. So as though it is fixed between the point between your eyebrows. Another important point is, when you imagine that your eyes are fixed at the point in between your eyebrows, the important point that Krishna is trying to stress here, it means that your eyes don't wander around. That's very important, because the minute they start wandering around and you see something, and then your attention again goes away towards that also. So do not fully close your eyes. If you fully close your eyes, what's the problem? Mind runs and you go off into a beautiful sleep, isn't it? So you can use meditation to practice sleeping. In case you can't sleep, meditation is very useful to practice. Definitely you will fall asleep. So keep your eyes open until you are able to master the mind, and then slowly learn how to close the eyes also. Okay? Then the other thing is given here, Bahir Sprashan. It is actually spread all over the words, because the words are arranged in a way for us to recite, but when you read the words, they are not all linked together. So it is like poetry, you know, you write poetry, you want the first line to rhyme with the third line. So you write it in that way, but you can't, when you write a story, you can't read it that way. Okay? So you have to understand this. Bahir means outer, Sprasan means objects, Bahims means external. So what it means is that focus your mind, do not let it entertain thoughts of external objects, meaning all your relationships, all your possessions, whatever matters that you have pending, try to pull your mind back away from all these things, because these are what which are going to distort your time in meditation. So at least for the time that you have fixed, whether 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes for meditation, recollect and pull your mind back away from all the external objects, relationships, possessions and other what we call experiences that you have encountered for that day. So keep, withdraw your mind away from the external to minimize. So here what he's telling you is minimize all sorts of distractions, and that also includes sitting in a quiet place, away from distraction. So you should not be sitting near a kitchen or near the living hall where there is a possibility of distraction, right? And even if you are sitting in a quiet room, again, mind also can wander. So you got to be very conscious where your mind is running. And the early part of meditation, you will find that your mind will run. So don't try to suppress the mind by not thinking of anything. What should you do? You don't surprise, you cannot get your mind to be totally thoughtless. So what should you do? Huh? You be very conscious where your mind is running away. Right? You must be conscious. If your mind is running away, pull it back again. How do you pull it back? Recite a mantra, divert the mind. If you are not conscious, it will slowly just slip away to something else. And suddenly you find that, you know, you are meditating about something something else than God. So be very conscious. When your mind runs, pull it back. Again it runs, pull it back. Constantly you keep on practicing this, eventually you will find that you are able to control your mind. It won't happen easily, you will have to really practice. So practice is very important. So mentally again, renounce all your possessions and relationships. And in fact, in chapter 8 also, Krishna makes a very important point. In one of the verses he says, at time of death, whoever remembers me comes to me, gets moksha. And many people misinterpret this and say, doesn't matter, that means whole life I can lead a sinful life. At the end when I die, then I think of God and I get moksha. But is that going to happen? At the time of death, the type of life you have been leading, the type of things which are important in your life, what your mind values most, that is what you will be thinking at the time of death. So if you value possessions, if you value worldly pursuits, worldly desires, at the time of death, your thoughts will only be on those things. Don't think at time of death, suddenly you will start thinking of God. It is not going to happen. And furthermore, you do not know when you are going to die. Isn't it? Right? You have no control of when you are going to die. And if your mind is constantly occupied with all desires, at that point when death happens, you can know where your next life is going to be. Right? So that's why we develop this discipline as we are living, as we are conscious. Thoughts of God is constantly in our mind. That at the point of death, it becomes a very natural process. You will automatically think of God. In fact, you will only think of God. So, that is the practice he has given in 27. In 28, he carries on some more. He is summarizing basically this practice of meditation, which he will elaborate the whole thing again in chapter 6. In verse 28, he says, Yataha, there are three words here. Yataha, Indriya, Manaha, Buddhir. So there are three equipments that you have. Indriya is your intellect, Manaha is your emotional mind, Indriya are your senses, Manaha is your emotional mind, and Buddhi is your intellect. And what do you do? Having withdrawn. So very important, intellect has been withdrawn because through the study of the scriptures, your intellect is engrossed in God. Mind has been withdrawn. How? Through bhakti yoga, through prayers, through rituals, through chanting of mantras, you have also focused your mind also on God. Indriya, senses also have been withdrawn. How? Because you use your eyes and focus on a object, as I mentioned earlier, be it the Ishta Devata, be it the Om symbol, be it a flame, whatever it is. So now your senses are in your control, your mind is focused on God, your intellect is also disciplined by thoughts of God. Now all have been withdrawn. What do you do? He says, now you have to direct it in the meditation of God. So keep that mind focused. Because what is meditation? Meditation is fixing your mind on a thought for a period of time. That is meditation. Fixing your thought on a single point for a length of time. So this is what we have to do. Whether, as I said, the time of meditation is not important. Whether you do it for 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes. What is important is where your mind is for those 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So don't try in the beginning to sit down half an hour for meditation. It's not going to work. Even if you can get through 5 minutes of meditation, you have started to discipline your mind. And you will find that slowly that time increases. So yataha indriya mano buddhir, having withdrawn your senses, mind and intellect from external, be fully aware of where your mind, intellect and your senses are focused on. Krishna says, the second thing is, Vigata, in the third line, you see that Vigata, Ichha, Vaya, Krodha. Again, three qualities there. Ichha is desires which cause emotional disturbances. One is to pull your mind away from your desires, your worldly desires. Vaya is fear. Again, fear of many things that we have. One is to learn how to get rid of fear. The only possible way is to surrender it to the Lord. Leave everything in the hands of Lord. That time that you are sitting for meditation, give that time to Lord at least. The whole day you have been going about doing your things, whatever you want to do, but at least for the time of meditation, give yourself wholly to God. Your mind, your intellect, your senses. So Vaya, also surrender to the Lord. Krodha, your anger, your agitation, your frustrations, surrender that also to the Lord. All these emotion, inner emotions, you have to learn to push out. Basically, your past and future. Right? That's why in the English language, as I say, is very interesting. Past is what they call past tense. Present is what? Present tense. Future is what? Future tense. Past also is tense. Future also your tense. Present also your tense only. In all three periods of time, you are tense. Why? Because all the time the mind is wandering to the past or to the future. And the result, your past tense also, present tense also, future also tense also. So you have to learn to surrender at that point of meditation. And understand, meditation is not calming the mind. Many people think that when I can meditate, I will be able to calm the mind. Meditation is not to calm the mind. Why? Most of us, of course, meditation can be used to for health purposes. It can be used to lower your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and many, many other things. But that is one secondary part of meditation. And other people think, in meditation, I can calm the mind.
Your mind has to be calm in order to meditate. Right?
Exactly. So, you have to calm the mind in order to meditate. Not meditate to calm the mind. And why we say you have to calm the mind to meditate? Because you have already gone through karma yoga, you have gone through bhakti yoga, you have gone through jnana yoga. The reason why you did all this was to purify and calm the mind so you could sit in meditation. So meditation is not to calm the mind. That thing has already got to be done earlier prior to you sitting down. Then the mind is calm, then you are able to focus it. So meditation is not a remedy to calm your mind. It is to use your calm mind in meditation and to realize God. And such a person, Krishna says, Munihi moksha parayanaha. Ayanaha means the goal, which is paraha, which means the highest goal, which is what? Moksha. This munihi here means the meditator, now having withdrawn from the external, his mind, his intellect, his senses, now should concentrate everything, all your energies on that one goal, which is moksha. That is your ultimate, that is your final goal. One should not lose sight in meditation. One should not lose sight that my ultimate goal is moksha. Munihi moksha parayanaha. And Krishna says, Yaha, such a person, Yaha sadaha, such a person is eva muktaha. Such a person is said to be eva muktaha, means truly free. Such a person is said to be a munihi, means he has evolved into a meditator when he has followed all these sequence of these practices of meditation to discipline the senses, the mind and the intellect. And what is the object of meditation? The object of meditation, Krishna describes in verse number 29, the closing verse of chapter 5. He says, may you meditate upon me, the Lord. And here he describes who is this Lord you should meditate upon. Bhoktaram, the enjoyer, one who is the enjoyer, Bhoktaram, of what? Yajna tapasam. Yajna, all the prayers that you have been doing through all your lives, all the rituals that you have been doing through all your lives. Tapas, all the austerities that you have been keeping, fasting, etc. Who is the receiver of all this, of your prayers, of your rituals, of your fasting, every spiritual practice that you have been doing through all your life, who is the receiver of all this?
Lord.
That is Lord. He says, I am the receiver. Think of me as the receiver of all your prayers, all your rituals, all the tapas, the austerities that you have kept. I am the ultimate receiver of all that. Bhoktaram yajna tapasam. Of all your pujas. And who else is this Lord? Second line. Sarva Loka Maheshwara. Maha Ishwara. The great Lord who is Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, the master, the ultimate master, the creator of this whole creation. Maha Ishwaram. He is that ultimate, he is the creator of everything, of me, of the entire creation, of all the planets, of all the lokas. He is the Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. And furthermore, he is also the Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam. Sarva Bhutanam means, of all the creations, he is the Suhridam, he is the friend. And very important point to note here. When he says, I am the friend of all the creation, what does it mean to us? When Lord is saying, I am the friend of all the creation, what does it mean to us? Suhridam Sarva Bhutana. Suhridam means friend, friend of all. It means that all of us, whether saint or sinner, he considers all of us as equal. All of us have a chance to attain moksha. There is nobody who is disadvantaged or nobody who has bigger advantage. We all have a chance. So one should not look down upon ourselves. Many people say, but how am I going to achieve moksha? I have all these impure qualities. No. Krishna is saying, you just put in the effort. I am there as a friend to everybody. I receive all your prayers. I receive all your rituals. As long as you keep me in mind, I will always be there for you. That's why in chapter 9 he says, Name Dvesho Name Priya. There is nobody I hate more or nobody I love more. To me, all are equal. How much effort you put, I am ready to receive it. So all of us have a chance to attain moksha. Do not look down upon yourself. He is considering himself a friend to everybody, equally. And thus Krishna says, knowing me such as a friend of all, as the Lord of the universe, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram, as the Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam, as a friend of all, as the Bhoktaram Yajna Tapasam, the receiver of all your prayers, your rituals, your fasting, knowing me as this, Krishna says, Nyatva Shanti Brichati. One attains the state of Shanti. Brichati means attains. Shanti, you will attain that ultimate peace, which means what? You will attain both Jivan Mukta and you will also attain Videha Mukta. So ultimate liberation can come once you realize God as one within you and one who is the ruler of this entire creation. And thus he ends chapter 5. So are there any questions at this stage? Any clarifications you need? Any questions?
Just now earlier you spoke about desire and you said that it shouldn't be suppressed.
Right.
But it should, you should control it from being expressed.
Anger should be controlled, yes. Desire also should be controlled from being expressed.
So if you're not being expressed, means it's suppressed, no?
Correct. But you must therefore channel it in a different direction. So whatever desires we have, instead of just working to suppress them, it's not going to work. So what we do, we divert the attention of our mind towards a higher or noble cause. And that's why we take up seva, we take up prayers, we take up chanting of mantras, etc. The basic idea is to divert our mind away. So what happens to these desires? They get naturally diluted and replaced by higher desires, noble desires.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the example given of a river. If you dam the river, what happens? Then what happens? It overflows. It causes destruction. Eventually, it's got to find an outlet to burst somewhere, right? If you just dam it up. So what do you do to a river?
Divert it.
You channelize it. So you use it for irrigation. You use it for drinking water purposes. You utilize it in the right way. You divert it to the right direction instead of just damming it. So same way with desires and anger also. Instead of just working to suppress them, one should divert the attention away. First, don't let it express, and second is divert the mind. Because you cannot fully suppress the mind. It needs to, mind is what? Mind is defined as a flow of thoughts. So you cannot suppress all your thoughts, so you divert the thoughts. Channelize it in a different direction. That's why use everything that you have, your mantras, your prayers, whatever you have. And the most dangerous time, that your mind is running is when? The most dangerous time. When you are doing mechanical actions like driving, like cooking, that is when you find your mind runs into the wrong territory. When you are doing anything mechanical, that's when your mind tends to slip away. So that is the time when you are driving, when you are cooking, when you are doing mechanical things, that is the time you should engage in chanting mantras and doing something to keep your mind focused.
When you say mechanical means automatically you are doing it without
thinking.
When you are
driving, right? You are not thinking.
Okay,
when you are cooking, you are not thinking. So that is the time when the mind has a tendency to run. And imagine when you are cooking with all that anger and frustration, you are pouring in more poison into your food. So that is the time you are cooking, chant your mantras. Sing a bhajan. When you are driving, chant your mantras. Divert the mind. Any other questions? Yes.
Verse 29.
Verse 29, yeah. So here Krishna says, I, Krishna, am the receiver of all your prayers, of all your, the tapas that you keep, the austerity. Now here a very important point you must understand. When Krishna says, I, what does he mean? Does he mean the Krishna form? Yes, because many people, that's why they say, if I study Bhagavad Gita, then I cannot pray to Ganesha, I can't pray to Shiva. I am a Shiva devotee, I am a Ganesha devotee. If I come to Bhagavad Gita, must I only pray to Krishna? Because many times in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you will come to me, think of me, worship me. So when he says the word me, does it mean the Krishna form? Means the ultimate Brahman, the supreme consciousness, which is beyond form, which is beyond shape, which is beyond size, which is beyond color. So it doesn't matter why he says me. To us at the initial stage, me can mean any Ishta Devata that we accept. If we find Ganesha loving, this me can be Ganesha. This me can be Shiva. This me can be Devi. But ultimately we have to come to the formless. So when he says here me, don't take it in the stricter sense that it means a particular Krishna form. Because in chapter 14, he defines who is this me. If you look at chapter 14, okay, look at page 268. He's giving a definition of who is this me. Krishna is saying, page 268, chapter 14, verse 27, I am the abode of the imperishable Brahman. See? The Krishna form is only a temporary form that the Brahman has taken for a particular purpose, for a particular mission. So this Brahman has come in many forms, has come in Rama form, is coming Ganesha form, Shiva form, is coming so many forms. So here he is saying, I am the abode of the imperishable Brahman. Abode meaning I am the nature of that imperishable Brahman, immortal. That means someone which is something, when we say something is imperishable or immortal, which means it is beyond shape, is beyond size and form. Because anything that is a form is subject to change. Isn't it? Anything that is a form is subject to arrival and departure. So that ultimate God has got to be beyond all this. So me means you must take it in a very bright, broader prospect. Okay. We have a couple of minutes, so I don't want to go into the next chapter because then you lose that the track. So we'll come and start next week. Since we have a few minutes, whatever doubts you have, you can use it to, you know, to clarify. Yes.
You said just now about if we can understand the purpose of life.
Purpose of human birth. Human
yeah,
birth.
Purpose
yeah.
of our birth.
Yeah.
Then we can understand all this better.
Right.
So can I say that the purpose of human birth is to realize the self and achieve moksha?
Exactly. Exactly. Which? Why do we say? To realize the self and to attain moksha is the purpose of human birth. Why? Why do we say this? Why do the scriptures say this? What is the reason?
To liberate ourselves.
Yes, why? Why is that the purpose of human birth?
Right.
Because such a goal of moksha or self-realization is not available to any other creatures or any other creation of Lord. To study the scriptures requires the capacity of the intellect, which is not available to animals, insects, etc. To make choices, this is the biggest gift we have been given in this human form, is to make a choice. We have free will. We can decide for ourselves which direction we want our lives to go. Which that free choice of free will is not again given to animals, to plants, to insects, etc. So having been given free choice, having been given this capacity of intellect to understand God, to worship God, I should then know how to use what I have been gifted with and achieve my goal. Otherwise, I have wasted what the scriptures say. If you do not utilize your intellect, your mind to attain God, if you do not use your free will to attain God or moksha, you have literally committed suicide. The scriptures say this, Atmana, you have literally, Atmana Hanam, you have literally killed yourself. Meaning what? You have wasted this human birth. You do not know the purpose of human birth. It is like you are given a beautiful car, a Mercedes, you don't know how to drive, what do? You end up crashing the car. So you've been given this body equipped with free will, equipped with intellect for the purpose of attaining God. If you do not know the purpose of this body and you use it for wrong reasons to satisfy your desires, to satisfy your ego, then you pay the price for that. You have wasted one human birth. And you know what is the biggest danger if you waste this human birth? You are never sure what is the next birth you are going to get. So this opportunity you have been given, utilize it intelligently. Because you do not know what is your next birth.
Krishna is referring to I, here we understand that he is referring to Brahman.
Brahman, exactly. So when he says I, it's not Krishna form, it's
yeah.
Brahman.
Okay. How do you relate this with other faiths?
Other faiths means like?
You see, like, we have today, we are talking about all the various religions.
Right.
You know, they say, my God, my God.
My God, yeah.
And in the name of God, we are also fighting.
Right.
So, how would you relate Krishna's teachings, you know, when we refer to the other religious
teachings? You look at chapter 7. chapter summarize the first concept. Okay, look at chapter 7. Where's the verse? Asha, you remember whichever way men approach me? Okay, just look at chapter 7, verse 21. Page 144. Whatever form a devotee seeks to worship with faith, I stabilize the faith of that particular devotee in that very form. So it doesn't matter, I can't remember, there's one more verse, which chapter, whichever way men approach me, I accept. So ultimately, there is only one formless God. But you can approach him from different ways, different religions, different deities. But ultimately, the ultimate goal is only one. That's why the Vedas also say very beautifully, Ekam Sat Vipra Vahuda Vadanti. Ekam one Sat, there is only one truth. There is no 10 gods, 100 gods, there is only one ultimate Brahman, Ekam Sat. Vipra means the wise ones, those sages. Vipra Vahuda means in many ways, Vadanti, they speak of the truth in many ways, but they are only speaking of that one truth. Whether they tell you in story form, whether they tell you this way or that way, or they sing bhajans, ultimately they are only speaking to you about that one truth. Every spiritual discourse you can attend is only speaking to you about that one truth. But they have different ways to communicate that idea. So whatever, even the other religion, one day, I don't know, maybe we all come to realize that actually there is only one God. We have just been approaching him from different ways. And even if you look at Guru Granth also says the God is formless, nameless, you know. Again, Islam also same, formless. And I believe all the other religions, ultimately they are all saying the same one thing, that the God is actually formless, but we are worshipping him in whatever form it is. Again, it goes from person to person, you know. Just like again in our Hinduism, there is so many again Vaishnavites, again Shaivites and all this. But actually ultimately we are praying to one form only. That's what we have to realize. Instead of creating division, we should create.
The problem is for us pointing at the form that we are creating. A lot of forms we have created.
Right.
That is where the whole problem lies. You are not praying in so many forms.
You see, problem arises when you don't understand. And even in our own Hindus, unfortunately, we also get confused. Why do we have so many forms? Right? And then we feel inferior, that something wrong with our religion, you know. But we understand it, why the form is there. Then we know how to progress gradually. Sorry? Form is to concentrate, exactly. Yeah. So you must understand the purpose. Why we have been given so many forms?
I think the bulk of the problem is lacking knowledge.
Lacking knowledge, exactly. Yes. Yes. And that's why we have to come ultimately to knowledge. We start with rituals, prayers, etc., go to temple. Ultimately, you have to come to knowledge. And then you understand everything that you've been doing. What is the ultimate goal of all your prayers? As he says, I am the ultimate receiver of all your prayers and rituals and pujas and all that. Right? Yes.
One last question.
Sure.
You know, we read all these verses and we listen to you sharing all this with us. But it's very difficult to actually practice them consistently. How do you actually get to practice it consistently, whatever that's being taught?
See, first of all, when we do sravanam, listening, what we lack is mananam, reflection. We do a lot of listening. We go to spiritual lectures, we listen. But what we don't need is in our own reflection. So that's why very important every day for us to set aside time to study the scriptures and reflect upon what we have heard. Because until we reflect and on what we have heard, then only it becomes a conviction. Right now it is knowledge. It is just information. It has not become a conviction in us. So it is not cause a transformation, it remains information. In order for information to lead to transformation, there has got to be constant reflection. Reflection, what you've heard, what you've read, question, keep on questioning, keep on what you call reflecting on that knowledge until you're convinced. Once you're convinced on that knowledge, you will be able to apply it automatically. You don't even have to think about it. It is there within you already. Right now, it is knowledge, it has not become conviction.
So I know the word reflection, but I'm not sure whether I have the correct understanding of the word. What
is reflection basically? As we are reading, we don't question. We just read, okay, Krishna says like that, okay. Why didn't you question? Why does he say like this? Why does he not say like that?
Okay.
Right? The minute you start questioning, your mind starts thinking. And then, you see, if you just listen to me, right now you may agree with me. Tomorrow you forget everything. Right? But if you go back and you read and try to understand with your own intellect, then it becomes a conviction. Then you will never forget it. Right? So that questioning, that looking into it deeply, into word by word, even if you read one verse a day is enough. You don't have to go and read 10 verses or 15 verses. Just attempt to make sure, discipline yourself to sit down and read one verse a day. There are 700 verses in the Gita. In 2 years you complete the whole Gita. Then you take over and give lectures, I can No, so that daily reflection is very important, right? Okay, you end with a prayer. Vasudeva Sukam Devam Kansa Chanura Mardanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru. Thank you. No, I have a problem now. I think we have oversold the ticket. So I'll pass. I think we have oversold the tickets.
What?
We have oversold the tickets. So what I'll do is, do you want me? So at least.